Thank you. I'd like to talk to you today about some ideas about evolution and the grand sweep of evolution from the very beginning up to today. But before I do that, I'd like to talk a bit about the way in which the world is changing because of the DNA sequencing. And one of the ways of seeing that is a curve, is this curve, which shows the amount of sequence deposited in the computer databases, GenBank, Nimbo, and the database in Japan. Year by year, we've now achieved almost two and a half gigabases of DNA sequence, and that curve seems to go almost straight up. It's more illuminating to plot that curve on a log plot. And what you see is that, in fact, the accumulation of information in DNA sequence has been following a straight line, a perfect exponential, essentially since the discovery of the rapid methods of sequencing in the middle 1970s by Fred Sanger and his coworkers, and myself and my coworkers. This curve extrapolates back down to zero, essentially at 1975. Back in the early 70s, we sequenced a small fragment of DNA, the LAC operator, and it took Alan Maxman and myself 2 years to work out 24 bases of DNA, essentially a rate of one a month. I had a graduate student do another sequencing project around 1975. She worked out 63 bases of DNA by copying it into RNA. It was the very sequence at the beginning of the lactose operon, and she got a thesis. We then discovered essentially the rapid methods for DNA sequencing. In our case, a chemical method, in Fred Sanger's case, an enzymatic method. And those methods changed the efficiency from one in which you could work out, as I said, one base a month, to one in which in a single afternoon you could work out several hundred to 1,000 bases of DNA. And the next thesis in my laboratory was a student who worked out a single gene, about 1,300 bases of DNA, got his thesis. The next thesis was 5,000 bases of DNA. And then we essentially stopped doing DNA sequencing and giving theses for it. But in fact, in the world, the most recent thesis given purely for DNA sequencing was for 4 million bases of DNA. As a graduate student who worked out the sequence of an entire bacterium, in her case, with a few technicians as help. And because she had had some help, she didn't just get a thesis for the DNA sequence, she also had to spend about half a year trying to interpret it. The accumulation of information here is actually going up, as you can see from this slide, about a factor of 10 every 5 years. A factor of 100 in a decade. A factor of 2 every 18 months. There are only two processes in the world that are moving with this rapidity. One is this accumulation of biological information reflected by the DNA sequence, and the other is the power of the computer chips, which also goes up a factor of 10, reflected either in the fall in price or the increase in memory or the speed of the chips. Goes up a factor of 10 every 5 years. In that case, that process, that relationship is called Moore's Law after the CEO of Intel who first formulated this as a regularity. You should realize that in science in general, for the entire history of science of the last 300 to 400 years, the information in science has accumulated a factor of 2 every 10 years. And that regularity is reflected in the number of journals and the number of papers and in the number of scientists, going back essentially to the Industrial Revolution. The number of scientists has doubled every 10 years. That fact alone is often reflected in the statement that 90% of the scientists who have ever lived are alive today. And that fact alone is generally reflected in the way in which the science that we normally do changes over time. That fact is actually also related to the social problems that science is now beginning to have, because the number of scientists is now beginning to be of the order of 1% or so of the population, and we cannot continue to double every 10 years without running into a physical barrier of the entire population. But the return to the DNA sequencing. The information is going up much, much faster, as I said, a factor of 10 every 5 years. And for the students here, that means when you enter the university, there'll be 10 times more information available in biology by the time you graduate. And if you, from the time that you enter the university to the time that you take your doctorate, roughly 10 years later, there's 100 times more information. And the prospect of the Genome Project is, in fact, the continuation of this curve over the next, at least an order of magnitude, and possibly for several cycles beyond that. And so that the prospect of the future is that the information will actually continue to accumulate at this rapid rate. And that means that you should realize that your education, if you look on your education as the accumulation of facts about biology, the rate at which those facts will actually accumulate in the world is much more rapid than you can ever catch up with. And that that's not the secret of your education. The actual role of education is to try to give you methods to grasp new facts and new approaches. And you should realize that the science that we will do 3 years and 5 years from now will look very different than the science that we do today, just as the science that we do today looks very different from the science that we did when I first began to do biology almost 40 years ago. What I'm saying is they're going through an information explosion. The explosion shows up first in the databases of gene sequence, which are being filled now as we complete the human genome. The databases of protein structure are being attacked again with the same sort of feeling as the Genome Project, that the X-ray crystallographers should in fact make an effort to do all possible novel protein structures over the next few years. Databases of essentially biochemical interactions of the classic form are known. Databases of the interactions of proteins with each other for all of the genes will in fact come into existence, I think, over the next few years. And this is actually going to change a component of the biology that we do. For the last several decades, and for the last, in fact, entire cycle, essentially the information content of biology was experimental. And if you wanted to do biology, you had to do it by going to the laboratory, going out to the world to look at things, or going into the laboratory to change things. Today, however, the information begins to be theoretical. And I think a theoretical biology is beginning to emerge. There's one kind that you are probably quite aware of. It's the fact that one can discover genes in databases more and more over the last few years. And that discovery, by looking into the electronic databases, leads one to new experiments. I think there's a deeper form of theoretical biology which is about to emerge. And that is, in fact, that one can look at the database and discover facts in the database that lead to different or new conceptual understandings. And that's beginning to occur dramatically in the field of molecular evolution. And I think it will continue dramatically as the genomes, both of humans and of the model organisms, get sequenced, and people begin to stare at those genomes and learn things from them that they didn't expect at all. I'm going to talk to you today about one such novel thing, fact that's emerged in the database. It's related to what I call the exon problem. And I can phrase that situation to you as a debate or an argument between two extreme views of the world. One view is, and the view that I will argue for, is that introns, in fact, arose very early and were used to assemble the first genes. The alternative view of the world is, in fact, just the opposite. Introns were added very late in evolution, and they broke up previously continuous genes. Why might one think that? Well, let me summarize some of the properties of introns and exons for you to remind you. If we look around the genes in plants or in vertebrates or in our bodies, you'll see those genes have an intron-exon structure in which the exons are moderately short pieces of DNA coding for moderately short amino acid sequences, 30 to 40 amino acids long. The exon sequences are conserved if we look at genes across homologous genes across great evolutionary distances. The introns, in general, are tenfold longer than the exons. They show no sequence conservation as you compare them, but different versions of the gene in different organisms, and no length conservation. The introns, in fact, range in length out to 10,000, 50,000 bases. The conventional intron is of the order of 1,000 bases long. The argument in general that we made many years ago was that introns will speed recombination and lead to the rearrangement of exons to make novel combinations in the course of evolution. And that's the view that if we look at a gene with an intron-exon structure, the introns are the sort of leftover glue used to put the exons together. Why would we think introns would speed recombination? This is a way, simple argument. If we want to make a novel gene consisting, let's say here, of a red part that comes from one gene and a blue part that comes from another, we can make such a novel gene by breaking and joining the DNA between these two copies in a fashion here called illegitimate recombination that will make a exact connection between the sequence that encodes this red portion and the sequence that encodes this blue portion to make a novel gene. We know that this is a rare event. We know it can occur in bacteria, and we could actually estimate a rate for it from experiments in bacteria. Suppose, however, these gene products are the products of genes that have an intron-exon structure and so are separated along the DNA by 1,000 or 10,000 bases. We again bring up these two DNA regions to each other. That same sort of illegitimate recombination, which sees a rare coincidence, short coincidence of bases, now can occur anywhere in the sequence here between these two exons or anywhere in the sequence in the second gene between these two exons, to make a new combination that has a DNA combination that has this first exon and this second one. If you think about the number of ways this recombination can occur, you will realize that this process is of the order of 1 million to 100 million times more rapid than this classical process. And by being more rapid, it's a process that then can occur much more freely in evolution in the species to make novel gene combinations. And that's the core of the argument, that if you have introns, you would then expect some level of exon shuffling, and that that would be a basic mechanism to make novel proteins. And there are many examples in the protein world of such genes and such obvious proteins obviously constructed that way. The issue really arises, the issue I want to discuss arises, if we say, well, this is an excellent method for making new proteins, when did it begin? Did it begin at the beginning of the metazoans? At the Cambrian explosion, did some magic element insert introns into all the previously existing genes and then exon shuffling made the proteins that we have in our bodies? Or possibly did this begin at the very beginning of evolution, in which we might make the first genes by this sort of rule? That is it possible that the very first genes were made by exon shuffling to make novel combinations of new genes? Or were the first genes made as continuous holes and interrupted somewhere in the course of evolution by introns adding to them to break them up? You realize there's always been a conceptual problem posed by the fact that if you ask, how would I make a 200 amino acid long protein, let's say, by a random process, you find it's very, very difficult or impossible to imagine how that might happen because there are too many different possibilities to make a very long protein. There are 20 to the 200th power possibilities of sequence. Whereas if I make that same long sequence by little short pieces of peptide, I can see how I might have found those short pieces of peptide by random processes. And what I'm suggesting to you is a way of looking at evolution that is peculiar in terms of the classical view, because the classical view of evolution is that we begin with things that look like the bacteria, and maybe the archaebacteria, and then we finally get down to the eukaryotes by making a combination of cells that are all thought of as looking like little versions of the bacteria by the invasion of one cell to another to add mitochondria, chloroplasts, and make eukaryotes. And I'm suggesting something different, which is a view of evolution in which the first organism has an intron-exon structure. We get a last common ancestor of the bacteria, the archaebacteria, the eubacteria, and the eukaryotes that still has an intron-exon structure. And that down the line then that leads to today's bacteria or today's archaebacteria, the introns are lost and the DNA is simplified. And down the line that leads to the eukaryotes, we retain the introns. This turns this original view of evolution on its head. And so a consequence of the idea that introns are very early is an altered view of what is early and what is late. It is actually, in some ways, the view that the bacteria are highly evolved, degenerate organisms, rather than being simple primitive organisms. And to support that, I'll simply point out to you that the generation time of the bacterium is much shorter than the generation time of a eukaryotic cell, and therefore, in fact, the bacteria are evolutionarily very far more evolved. They've gone through more generations and have had more time for evolution to work on them than are the cells in our bodies. The argument that I pose, these two early introns or late introns, has been sort of going back and forth between two sides for the last 15 years or so. The two sides look at the world and come to essentially opposite conclusions. The facts about the world are that the bacteria and the very simple eukaryotic cells have no introns, while the vertebrates and the plants have many introns. One side of this, those of us who believe that there are early introns, think that this is evidence for the loss of introns and that the loss process will be easy. The other side thinks that this is evidence that the gain is easy. The idea that the first genes are put together from exons suggests immediately that the exon should represent some sort of coherent unit, small unit of structure or function, primarily structure, that you might shuffle to make new combinations. It would suggest that you should find a modular structure for proteins, and you would be led to expect that there should be some correlation of introns with a three-dimensional structure of proteins. The two sides of this argument generally simply disagree about this outcome. Those who believe that the introns are early very often find examples where they say clearly that proves there's a correlation of introns with three-dimensional structure. Those who think introns are late generally deny such a correlation. And you find introns at very similar positions. When you look at, let's say, generally genes, homologous genes, genes that have a common evolutionary ancestor across the different vertebrates, you will find introns basically always in the same position. As you begin to look across the vertebrates to the flies or the worms, you'll find most introns in the same position, but you'll find an occasional intron one or two bases differently. The people who believe that introns are inserted argue that all of these cases are examples of introns being inserted because you would not expect to find in an ancestral organism introns one base apart. Those who believe the introns are early argue that all these cases are examples of intron movement at some point in the evolutionary background of this gene. And again, such examples aren't usable as ways of determining what the outcome of this should be. Let me describe for you for a moment an idea about the origin of genes that I call the exon theory of genes. It is just a restatement of the idea I said to you that maybe the first genes were made up of introns, but the full argument is really that the first genes were essentially coded for essentially very short polypeptide chains, essentially open reading frames, fragments of amino acids, 50 to 20 amino acids long, that these peptide chains had a structure, enough structured solution to aggregate, and those aggregates made the first enzymes. That you then assembled more complicated genes out of these exons to make those aggregates now covalently connected. That the method of making novel genes was then to shuffle the exons to make novel products. And over a revolutionary time, one fused exons together to make more complicated exons. We, in fact, know a process that does that. It's called retroposition. You have a gene, let us say, that has an intron exon structure. We make an RNA copy of that that has now been spliced, so it has lost that intron exon structure. We make a DNA copy of that and reinsert that copy back into the chromosome. If that DNA copy is inserted back into the chromosome, not in the neighborhood of any gene, it becomes a pseudogene. And in our bodies, there are pseudogenes corresponding to very many of the other of the normal genes. But if that copy is inserted back into an intron in some other gene, this that novel combination, which is now the fusion of several exons, can be spliced onto the other exons of that gene. There's a complete, there are several complete examples of this process. There's an example in Drosophila, in which in the last 6 million years, the ADH gene, the alcohol dehydrogenase gene, was taken, a completely cDNA copy of that gene, which normally has four exons, was reinserted into the C-terminal end of another gene, and a novel gene was made and used in the Drosophila. I tell you that because of to argue that the original exons might have been 18 to 20 amino acids long, today's distribution of exons looks like this. It's peaked around 30 to 40 amino acids. To argue the original exons were down at this length, you have to realize that I am arguing that in the history of all of today's exons, there has been of the order of 2 to 3 fusion events to make the more complicated exons we see today. And for those of you that like immunology, we're really arguing that the basic exon of immunology that has the immunoglobulin fold, which is about 120 amino acids long, is the fusion of a set of much more primitive exons. I want to try to distinguish these ideas for you. The idea that either, let's argue, exons might have been there from the beginning and were lost or gained since, is what I call it, from two other possibilities. That the introns only arose at the beginning of the multicellular organisms, and we had exon shuffling since then, or that the introns are still arising dramatically in evolution, and there basically is no exon shuffling. How might we study this? We study this by looking at what we call ancient conserved genes, or ancient conserved proteins. Those are proteins in which we have a prokaryotic version in the bacteria, which has no introns, and a eukaryotic version, which in fact will have introns. So these proteins are proteins that are homologous between the bacteria and the eukaryotes. Such proteins are things like the RNA polymerase. They are, of course, the basic genes of biochemical metabolism. They are all proteins that we think came into existence in the common ancestor of the eukaryotes or the prokaryotes, and have evolved since. And what you generally see for such proteins is a considerable amount of amino acid conservation, which enables you to identify these regions. These regions are collinear between the prokaryotic gene that has no introns and the eukaryotic gene that has introns. So there can be some shuffling in the history of these genetic regions. And the two ways of looking at the world make profoundly different predictions just about these introns. The introns' late view says all of these must be inserted. There can be no other way in which those introns can arise in these proteins because this region is collinear with an ancestral region which had no introns. The introns' early view says, no, in fact, some of these introns could be left over from exon shuffling in the common ancestor. And therefore, some of these introns might be related to the three-dimensional structure of the protein. For many years, going back to Matiku Go, people have suggested that you might find a relationship between exons and compact regions of the protein called modules. And I'd like to show you that we can find some evidence for this relationship. What do I mean by a module? I mean a segment of the polypeptide chain that's folded back and is compact on itself. And a way of defining that is by looking at the polypeptide chain in space and asking that there be some maximum distance between all the amino acids in that segment of the chain. It's a picture rather like this. Here we have a little bit of polypeptide chain, an alpha helix followed by some repeat. And if we can circumscribe that by a sphere, and over the years we used the sphere about 28 angstroms in diameter, we call that a compact region, we call that a module. And the conjecture for a long time, going back, as I said, to Matiku Go, has been that maybe such modules corresponded to the original exons. The problem with phrasing that conjecture in a precise way has generally been that there was no obvious way of defining the boundaries of such compact regions. You might have a pattern of a protein that looked like this, and you might not know where along here you might expect to find an intron. If you wanted to ask, can I predict a correlation of introns with the boundaries of such structures? Or you might have structures like this, in which this would be a module by the definition I've just given you. This would be a module. But where should I say the boundary of the module is? A postdoctoral student of mine, Sandra D'Souza, found a few years ago a way of solving this problem that gives us a simple statistical test that introns are or are not related to such compact units of the protein. The way of solving the problem is to take a protein chain, here shown in red, try to dissect it into these compact regions by circumscribing each region as best one can with a sphere of a certain diameter, and then taking the regions of overlap between these spheres and calling those the boundary regions between the modules. Because such boundary regions would then have the property that if one had an intron here and an intron there, this exon would correspond to this particular module. Now, the advantage of that definition is that it can be turned into a computer algorithm. So one can write a simple computer program that predicts all those boundary regions. And therefore, we can then ask in a simple fashion, is there an excess of introns in such boundary regions? To show you a little bit about what that looks like, here is a protein dissected that way. And the regions we're calling modules are these loops in the protein structure. And the regions we're calling boundary regions, overlaps between modules, are in fact, in this case, these parts of these alpha helical returns. How can we test whether there's an excess of introns in such regions? To remind you, we're looking at protein structures of known three-dimensional structure for which we have a bacterial gene with no introns, and we have a set of eukaryotic genes that are all homologous and collinear, and there'll be introns in those. And what we do is to identify the position of each of these introns. Here we might have three in the same position. We identify all these as positions in the sequence that corresponds to this three-dimensional structure. The computer program identifies about a series of regions along this sequence as the boundary region of modules. The introns late hypothesis would say that all of these intron positions should be essentially random with respect to this three-dimensional structure. And therefore, we can ask, is there an excess of these positions in the boundary regions or not, and have a very simple statistical test for that. And the first time we did that, the boundary regions are about one-third of the protein sequence, and we simply have to ask, is there an excess of intron positions in such regions? The first time we did that, we took a set of about 32 ancient proteins. We took the 570 intron positions that we would find in the homologs of these proteins. We expect 182 within these boundary regions. We found 214. It's a small excess, but it's in fact highly significant. I'm going to show you a much more sophisticated way of doing that calculation, because we went on to increase the number of proteins, since there's a lot more in the database. We actually added to the 32 ancient proteins we had used in that first calculation another dozen to get up to 44 ancient proteins, taking, in fact, examples that had been published a few years ago of protein families that people thought were examples of the intron late school of viewpoint. And we're going to discuss sort of 44 proteins and about 1,000 introns. And what I'm going to show you is the correlation of those intron positions with the module boundaries for different sizes of modules. Since we have a computer program that will ask, that will predict what are the boundaries for modules of any given size, 20 angstroms, 25, 30, and so on, we can in fact ask, was that position that I had taken before, 28 angstroms, in fact the optimum size in any way? And what you see is, in fact, that we see correlation of intron positions with the module boundaries for modules around 21 angstroms in diameter, for modules around 27 angstroms in diameter, and modules around 32 angstroms in diameter. And the correlations get out to probability value, chi-squared values above 10, and probabilities of about 1 part 1,000. We previously were sitting somewhere here on that curve. It is interpretable. It says two things. There are three sizes of units in protein structure with which we can see correlations of introns with those elements of size. What are those sizes? One of the ways of asking is to ask not is what is the physical diameter of this compact region of protein, but what is the length of the amino acid chain that is in those regions. And if I plot here the length of the amino acid chains in those three peaks, you'll see that the average chain length is about 15 amino acids in that shortest peak, is about 20 to 22 amino acids in the middle peak, and about 30 amino acids in the larger peak. That is, we actually find, by looking at a large number of ancient proteins and a large number of introns, a pattern that is very reminiscent of that pattern that I suggested on totally hypothetical grounds in the exon theory of genes, that we might expect to see correlation of the order to amino acid fragments of the order 15 to 20 amino acids long and multiples of that. We can go even further. There's a property of intron that we call intron phase. The intron lies in the DNA at some position in the DNA sequence. The DNA is copied out in the RNA, and the intron is then spliced out of the RNA. After that, the RNA can be read in triplet phase to produce a series of proteins. If the intron, when it lay in the DNA, lies in a position that after it's removed corresponds to a position between the ultimate codons, we speak of that intron as being in phase zero. If the intron lies in DNA after the first base of a codon, we call that phase one. After the second base of a codon, we call that phase two. You should realize that that's a property that's defined only sort of very much after the fact. Until we know the reading frame, do we know how this sequence is read out in amino acids, there is no such thing as a property of phase zero, phase one, or phase two. But of the 1,000 introns we're looking at, almost half are in almost half are in phase zero, and about half are in phase one or two that lie inside the codon. We take the same data I've just shown you, and if we break it apart into those two classes, you see a rather surprising result that for the introns that lie in between the codons, we see again a peak around 21 angstroms at a peak in size around 27 and around 33 angstroms. But for the introns that lie in between the codons, we see essentially no correlation. That is, we see a profound difference between the introns that lie in between the codons and those that lie inside the codons, in that those that lie between the codons are correlated with three-dimensional structure, substructure, that we've called modules. And in fact, this correlation is of the order of factor 10 better than the one I showed you before, which is roughly what you'd expect if you removed a random background. This experiment actually, I call it an experiment, but it is, as you realize, a computer experiment. This experiment actually removes a number of, or eliminates a number of the possible sources of artifact, because you would not expect any of the sources of artifact that might be upsetting our calculation to be able to tell the difference between introns that lie in between the codons and introns that lie inside the codons. But biologically, of course, the two are different. And in the 44 proteins, as I said, a little more than half the introns lie in between the codons, and about 20 to 23% lie in phase one or in phase two. If you thought about that original world that we hypothesized, in which there were exons shuffled in all possible combinations, you might ask, well, what sort of phase would the introns be in? And if you think about it, you realize that the easiest way of the introns, of the exons being always shuffleable into new combinations, is for all of the introns to be in the same phase. If we have added introns to the DNA, you might expect the introns to add randomly in all three phases. And so you might expect there to be equal number of introns in phase one or phase two or phase zero. So I can look at these numbers and say the most likely interpretation is that, in fact, these numbers, the number for phase two, let's say, measures essentially a background of added introns. And the excess, the 30 percentage points excess in phase zero, represents the ancient introns. So I'm going to leave you with that conclusion that approximately 40% overall, 30 to 40% of today's intron positions lie in phase zero and are correlated with three-dimensional elements of protein structure and are candidates for ancient introns. While conversely, a large fraction also of the introns have been added in these ancient proteins, about 60% overall. They're not correlated with three-dimensional structure. They lie in all three phases and they're candidates for added introns. And this is a mixed view of the world compared to that extreme that I suggested to you at the beginning of the two polar views. It's perfectly satisfying to me. It's not necessarily satisfying to those who believe that introns are only late, because it contains in it the germ of a statement that there are introns that are correlated with three-dimensional structure, that they do behave, they are primarily introns that lie between the codons. They are candidates for, in fact, being very ancient introns. And that would be suggest that, in fact, the first proteins were assembled by an intron exon structure. And that suggests, in fact, that those original organisms had a splicing mechanism, had a complex genome, and that we ourselves are inheritors of a gene structure that is much more ancient than people normally think. The work I've described to you is not done solely by myself. It was done by a group of postdoctoral people, graduate students, undergraduates. Thank you very much.